Honorable House Committee on Judiciary to order Tuesday, February 22nd, 2011. Staff, what do we have today? You've got someone's interest, it looks like.
Chairs, members of the committee, on today's agenda is House Bill 2712. It modifies presumptive fines for violations, establishes the same as minimums, and prohibits downward deviation. It modifies maximum fines for violations by individuals and corporations. It provides for notice of presumptive minimum fines on the face of the citation. It modifies minimum fines for crimes, permits courts to waive in whole or in part, sets minimum fines for specific methamphetamine crimes, sets range of fines if ordered for reduced crimes, requires assessment of minimum fine for crime upon sentence of discharge. It establishes a structure for disposition of fines collected through traffic offenses by circuit courts, justice courts, and municipal courts, removes priority structure at ORS 137-300, and establishes five priority levels for distribution of payments on criminal judgments received from defendants. It ranks compensatory fines first, that's ORS 137-101. It ranks restitution and money awards and monetary obligations payable to the state not otherwise provided for second. It ranks fines payable to the county or city third. Ranks payments to specific accounts or public bodies fourth. Ranks rewards fifth. Replaces criminal fine and assessment account with the criminal fine account, or CFA. Permits allocations for listed purposes. Prohibits allocation for debt service obligations, expresses legislative intent to make allocations consistent with historical funding, requires the Department of Revenue to establish processes by rule for distributions from CFA and for proportionate reductions if CFA funds are inadequate, requires distributions for biennium beginning July 1, 2011 as specified, modifies payment to public defense services account in general fund, requires defendant to pay such account upon appointment of counsel at the beginning of the case, requires defendant to pay balance into CFA upon conclusion of case, prioritizes payment at the conclusion of the case at the second level, conforms language and statutes listed to correctly reference presumptive fines and distribution structures and to create consistent use in terms, declares an emergency as effective July 1, 2011. This bill is one of three measures resulting from the efforts of the Joint Interim Committee on State Justice Revenues, Justice System Revenues, which I'll refer to as the committee, which was established by House Bill 2287 in 2009 and which met almost monthly between October 2009 and January of 2011. House Bill 2712 and its companion measures, House Bills 2710 and 2711, are intended to replace House Bill 2287, which sunsets June 30th, 2011, in order to continue adequately funding Oregon's courts. The committee was charged with studying the Oregon Judicial Department's fee collection and revenue distribution structure, identifying best practices with regard to same, and making recommendations to simplify it. The committee was guided by a number of principles, including a desire to preserve access and proportionality, to improve efficiency and cost savings, and to achieve a stable, predictable, and transparent flow of money that could be accounted for and easily understood by the public. All the materials collected and produced by the interim committee over the course of its progress are available at the legislature's website, http://www.leg.state.or.us/comm/lfo/home.htm. House Bill 2712 establishes uniform priorities for the application of payments received from defendants and creates a criminal fines account to centralize funds from which allocations may be made for specific purposes. Thank you for your patience.
Committee members, have you got that all memorized? Anytime you got a staff major summary over one page, look out. Okay, I want to have the governor's staff come up. I believe it's Stephen Powers and Fran, is it Lachinko, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Powers. I'm the Deputy General Counsel to the Governor and also the Governor's Public Safety Advisor. Distributing my testimony, and I won't go through all of that, just wanted to highlight one section, Section 45 of the bill. It's on pages 17 and 18, and that's about the arrest and return program or the extradition program. OPS has significant concerns with that portion of the bill because it does undo two legislative fixes that had been through this committee in 2003 and 2008. And so, looking the 2003 portion of it was that monies collected from defendants as restitution for the state's prosecution of expenses were to be deposited in the CFAA. In practice, however, those monies were collected as restitution for extradition related expenses were returned to the fund so that we could use that for returning offenders, be it on probation or post-prison supervision or parole. In 2008, there was also a fee that was added for compacted offenders that was segregated so that into the arrest and return budget such that those could be used for when they violated and we needed to pay for them to come back. So House Bill 2712 does undo both of these pieces of legislation, and there were some issues with tracking the funds that the governor's office is also concerned with. I won't go through all the details. You have the written testimony, but I and Fran Lushenko are available if you have any questions.
Any members, do you have any questions, clarifications, or anything? They're going to let you off easy, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to have Leah Kraft come up and Jonathan Ames, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leah Kraft. I'm the Governmental Affairs Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I will make this very brief. We just wanted to put on the record the fact that the current language in the bill includes the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, which the Addictions and Mental Health Division currently operates and maintains, and we have been before your committee already this session talking about possible fee increases to that fund to replenish it back to the operating budget that it had in the early 1990s. And we have a couple of questions about if this fund were to be wrapped up into the criminal fine account, how that would operate. As we indicated previously, our IDPF fund was at an operating budget of about $5 million a biennium. It's now at about $900,000. And so we would just like to ask to continue the conversation about how that fund would be replenished and operating under this piece of legislation.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames with Eames Consulting here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association. Ms. Kraft actually stole my thunder, and we did coordinate before. We also agree and have concerns about the use of the historical calculation to determine what amount should be included in this fund as far as pegging for the IDPF, the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund. Do we peg it, you know, as a recent history, or we should go further back? Because if you go further back, there was a more, obviously, a healthier amount in the IDPF. Now, the legislation that we brought before you, your committee, recently would replenish that. So we just like you to make sure that you keep a close eye on that as you're drafting this legislation to make sure that there's enough in that fund to help indigent folks. Thank you very much.
Questions, committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Leah, how much money are we talking about?
That's currently
you generally would be receiving?
This money, this fund was repurposed in the late 1990s, and it was at a very healthy operating budget of $5 million a biennium. After that money was repurposed, the operating budget went down to $900,000 a biennium, which is currently what we're operating at.
Okay, let's just follow up. So the way I get from you 2712 right now, you have no direction as to what's happening, what you were receiving?
Chair Krieger, Representative Olson, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mark Adams, Carl Myers, and Scott, is it Winkles?
Good Chair Krieger, members of the House Judiciary Committee, for the record, I'm Mark Adams. I'm Chief of Police for the City of Kaiser, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police to express our opposition to House Bill 2712. Let me begin by expressing our support for the desire to increase simplicity, consistency, and transparency to our criminal fines and assessment system. As you know, public frustration due to confusion and complexity often results in additional tension for the police officer during a traffic stop or a citation is issued. While we are supportive of the stated motivation of House Bill 2712, we have strong concerns with the bill as introduced and cannot support it. The purpose of my testimony today is to identify a few of our key concerns regarding House Bill 2712. In addition to our stated concerns, we also share a number of concerns that will be addressed by other public safety partners and victims' advocates. Our key concerns are that the draft no longer includes a clear prioritization of programs that are critical to the operation of the public safety system, like public safety training and victims programs. As you know, current statute states that the Legislative Assembly shall allocate monies in the account according to the following priority: public safety standards, training and facilities, criminal injuries compensation and assistance to victims of crime and children reasonably suspected of being victims of crime, forensic services by the Oregon State Police, including but not limited to the state medical examiner, and maintenance and operation of the law enforcement data system. We support the addition of language in the form of legislative findings that exist in the current law but not in the proposed draft that will identify the purposes of the account. While this language isn't binding to any legislative body now or in the future, it does provide a sense of explanation for the account and the reason entities are included as recipients. We expect that future legislatures will receive requests from programs that seek addition to the public safety account. The funding that results from the assessment of collections of fines is a limited revenue source, and the addition of program recipients over time could result and budget needs that exceed the capacity of the fund. I might add that we can't keep increasing the price, the amount of these fines. It's already so high that most folks choose to just not pay them. They just walk away. A police officer is embarrassed to write a ticket sometimes. While we're not suggesting that the legislative findings language remain unchanged, we are hopeful that the language would continue to emphasize public safety programs that are system critical and that law enforcement must depend on the state to uniquely provide. We're concerned that revenue to the system resulting from the changes outlined in House Bill 2712 will fall short of estimates and will create additional pressure on important public safety programs that receive funding from the account. While we believe that the Joint Interim Committee on State Justice System Revenue is committed to maintaining current revenue levels based on the values and stated purposes of the committee, we are unconvinced that the revised approach will meet this objective. In an environment where revenues are tight for all programs that depend on appropriations from the state, we are nervous about changes to the criminal fines process that include this risk. Our concern here is limited to the risk we believe is inherent with this proposal and is not intended to cast doubt on the integrity of the process used to estimate revenue. Police chiefs and sheriffs created the police training account more than 40 years ago to fund the training of Oregon's law enforcement officers through an innovative local-state partnership. Back in the early days, the police training account paid for the basic training and even reimbursed agencies for their employees' salary while attending the academy. This reimbursement even included overtime costs incurred by an agency necessary to compensate an officer while attending the academy. As you know, a lot's changed since this fund was established, and today it's called the CFA, and it funds a lot more than just law enforcement training. Over the years, the account debt was flowed with the additional and removal of account recipients and with large and larger share of the dollars going to the general fund. In 2001, Senate Bill 70 directed court-ordered funds and court-ordered payment to go directly to the general fund, a loss of approximately $14 million out of the CFA. In 2005, legislation was passed to limit the recipients of the public safety account to four prioritized purposes: including DPSST training, victims programs, OSP forensic services, and LEDs. Legislative findings were also adopted to explain the importance of these programs to the integrity and operation of our public safety system. And I'll conclude with the fact that police training isn't the most glamorous subject in the world, but for the law enforcement profession, it is a system-critical function of public safety. Each year, more and more responsibilities are added to a police officer's duties, and the training just never stops. They must be able to consistently apply knowledge accurately, fairly, and impartially, often with only split seconds, to render decisions with life and death implications. Officers that fail to meet our expectations face litigation, intense media scrutiny, and we expect our officers to be able to safeguard DNA evidence, to use communication and data technologies to address the growing threat of internet predation, and to intervene in domestic disturbances where we require them to handcuff abusers and safeguard victims in the most emotional and personal situations. The very nature of crime itself has evolved in ways never before imagined due to changes in technology, a more mobile society, and rapidly evolving world events. Routine public safety risk our officers deal with now, even in relatively small communities, can include the potential for domestic and international terrorism, concerns that have rarely been considered part of the police officer's role in the past. An ongoing commitment to public safety training will help ensure that officers arrive at their law enforcement agency assignments prepared to begin their important work, to do so with professionalism and competence, and return home safely to their families. Properly funding basic regional and leadership training programs offered by DPSST will help ensure that the public continues to view the law enforcement profession with trust and confidence. For all these reasons, law enforcement leaders are hopeful that the work of the Joint Interim Committee on State Justice Systems Revenue will continue to identify public safety training as a prioritized program within the public safety account. Thank you again for your work to improve our civil and criminal fines statutes and for prioritizing system-critical elements of public safety as you finalize draft language for induction in 2011. The OACP is very interested in participating in any stakeholders group you decide to form in order to work through these issues related to the draft language. Thank you.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, for the record, Scott and members of the committee. For the record, Scott Winkle is representing the League of Oregon Cities. We are appearing in opposition to House Bill 2712. We have a number of concerns regarding this piece of legislation, some of them were ably outlined by the police chief sitting next to me. We are additionally concerned about the loss of local control that this bill would result in. The bill creates a base fine and limits the ability of a municipal judge to reduce that fine, and it may be counterintuitive, but such a eliminating that discretion could have unintended fiscal impacts on both the state and local governments. What we've found in the past is that our police officers in our cities are reticent to impose, to write traffic tickets when they know that there is not going to be any discretion on the part of the judge. Our officers know the communities that they police. They know, have a pretty good idea who they're pulling over. They know what they're able to pay and what's going to alter that person's driving behavior. Additionally, if a person doesn't have the funds to correct, say, an equipment violation on their vehicle, they're probably not going to have the funds to pay a minimum fine. That fine is probably not going to be collectible. Because you've increased the fine doesn't mean that the city's going to be able to recoup the investment. Additionally, cities do a pretty good job of setting local public safety priorities. There are some cities in Oregon where I would tell you, don't speed. And those judges would probably not give you a break because in those communities they've had horrific incidences and the tolerance for traffic violations is very limited. In other cities, they feel that they can correct a person's driving behavior with a reduced fine and leave that person with a more positive experience of dealing with their local government. For these reasons, we are opposed to the bill. I'm eager for your questions.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carl Myers. I am the municipal court judge in the city of Jefferson and the city of Kaiser. I am here before you today on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association, both entities of whom I represent within this process. Both associations unanimously opposed those sections of this bill that take away judicial discretion, work unfair, treat people unfairly in a one-size-fits-all fine system. I have passed out some written testimony, and I think that I can limit most of my oral testimony to what's set forth there, but I want to call your attention to the two tables that I have attached. Those two tables set forth some of the circumstances or scenarios in which the one-size-fits-all, the presumptive fine being the minimum fine, work injustices throughout the system. Members of the committee, the people that appear in front of me, expect that if they have a good record, if they admit to the violation, they should get a reduction in their fine. They do not expect to be treated in the same way that somebody that has four or five convictions for the same thing, particularly within a recent period of time, they don't expect that they would pay the same fine that that person would pay. And we judges need the discretion to be able to work with those people, to educate them, to penalize them for violating the law, to make sure most of all that they do not re-violate the law, re-offend. And this system sends the system, the fine system proposed in 2712, actually has the opposite effect. It does not reward people with good records. It, in fact, rewards people with bad records, as Table 1 sets forth. The other reason that we like to have some discretion in fines, because we have to work with people with limited means and or a bad attitude about paying fines. And sometimes we can get compliance with fine payment by saying we're going to impose, say, the base fine, and we will reduce it if you make payments over time in a reasonable method under a financing arrangement. When you get to the end, I'll be able to reduce the fine, and that acts as a carrot. But what this bill does, and I might add, and I've said this before, one of the toughest jobs that a judge has is deciding with each case how much carrot and how much stick to use on a defendant. And you have taken away all of our carrots and imposed nothing but sticks with this fine arrangement. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just a comment or two, and I'll get to the other committee members. When we were going to increase fines a couple sessions ago, Representative Barker, then co-chair now, and Representative Olson, who did chase traffic lights all of his career, did express a concern about the lack of latitude for judges. And we talked about the 26-year-old mother, 7 in the morning, runs a stop sign, 2 kids in car seats, taking them to grandma. She's going to a minimum wage job. What is justice? It surely isn't a number that maybe takes her entire week's salary. I found it kind of strange at the time that people who were expressing the concern the most in the committee was enforcement people, recognizing that that isn't fair, that isn't just. And so as soon as we read the bill, I think this time we all came to the same conclusion that we're not going to let that happen. We're going to make sure the discretion gets back if we move this thing at all. And the other thing that comes to mind, sometimes young people, a young man, 16, 17, that first contact or two with police officers might set the tempo, what his viewpoint is, of law enforcement for the rest of his life. And if you can't be fair with them, give them a break, ask them to, I'm giving you a break now, you pay attention now. I think you create more of a hostile environment for both the young man as he grows older and the police officers too. So we'll deal with that when the time comes. Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree. My concern, though, is that it seems like there's been a lot of time and effort put into this particular draft, and I'm wondering if you were invited to the table during the interim committee work that was done.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, Representative Wand, I did serve on the in the task force, and the concerns we've expressed today were the concerns we expressed in the task force.
The OACP was not involved.
Representative Olson first, next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Adams, I just got a couple questions, Mr. Chair, to ask him, if you don't mind. How many years have you been the chief there now?
Chair Krieger, Barker, Representative Olson, I've been in Kaiser, I'm in my 14th year.
Okay. Yeah, follow-up. Have you seen an increase or a decrease in volume by your members as it applies toward traffic citations?
What I have seen, and I was just talking about this earlier today, is an increase, or overall there's a decrease in citations being issued, and in the citations being issued, years ago I would say maybe one in four citations was a written warning. Now it's like one in two. And I think that results, officers are just, you know, they would be totally justified in issuing a citation, but as the judge indicated, they're just sometimes, this isn't justice. This is just going to cream these people. So they get more written warnings now than I think ever before.
Just follow up, because I find it interesting your comment about you can't keep increasing the fine. And then you went on to mention that that you felt your officers were embarrassed, actually, to write. Or do you feel that that's somewhat of a general feeling across the state right now with other agencies as well?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I can't speak for everybody, but I kind of get that feel from listening to the guys on the street that and also listening to the courts. It's just these fines are... they're rent for some folks, and for, in some cases, a minor traffic violation, they're pretty steep. And as we have found in Kaiser, that we get more folks to pay off their fines through some pretty fancy financing structures than if we just demand it up front. If it's low enough, they'll pay it. They want to pay it, most folks, but some folks just can't. And I'm constantly preaching to my officers, we're not in traffic and law enforcement for revenue. That's, you know, in our budget, I call that gravy. We're in it to educate folks and to get voluntary compliance.
Okay. I just have one question, Judge Myers. Judge Myers, the question I have in regards that I see that this bill, what it would do is actually remove further discretion from the court for what you do with your decision and violations. What's your alternative? Do you dismiss? Do you discharge? If you're feeling like that's the direction that you go, or do you give the maximum fine?
Mr. Scogier, Representative Olson, that is a tough decision. We judges don't set public policy, so if the legislature tells us that such and such an act is a violation, I believe that if somebody commits a violation, they should be penalized. My dilemma is how much can I penalize them, get the issue across, educate them without working a hardship on them and being unfair to others, either similarly situated or with various fact and driving history situations. It becomes very difficult for us to work within the parameters as the minimum fine and the base fine become shrunk. We have difficulty as set forth in table one. The situation that gives me the most concern these days is I have somebody that does a California stop, a rolling stop, making maybe perhaps a right-hand turn. And they just don't come to a complete stop. The officer issues a citation. The minimum fine for that is $216. In the same arraignment session, I'll have somebody who blows a stop light. Clearly blows it. Seconds after the light turned red, they go on through. People coming from either direction are forced to do evasive maneuvers, stop suddenly, but the person has no other violations on their record. As low as I can go on that is 216, and I have to treat those people the same, although the activity is significantly different. The one point I want to get across to you is the people that pay these fines are just like you. Most of the people that I see are not repeat offenders. They are people who, because they're they've got things on their mind, they're distracted in some fashion, commit a violation. Go a little too fast, do a rolling stop. These people, for the most part, can be have reformed their behavior when the officer pulls them over. And a minimum fine would be significant enough to get them to comply with the law for a significant period of time thereafter. It's difficult to treat those folks the same way I would somebody else under a one-fine-fits-all situation scenario as set forth in 2712. But back to your question, Representative Olson, it is very difficult for judges to deal within these parameters in a fair way.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, actually, the question is for you. So, as I understand it, this is one of three bills that has come from this Joint Interim Committee on State Justice System Revenues. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we heard 2710 about a week ago.
Right. And Representative Nathanson came to speak about that in favor of it. So is there anybody going to be here speaking today who will be in favor of this bill?
Not on my list, I don't think. We could maybe go find somebody. But
thank you.
Yeah. Representative Garrett, you're next.
I wanted to...
Mr. Chair, I think he was on this committee, wasn't he?
And even I'm not going to speak in favor of it, actually, yet. But I wanted to respond to Representative Wan's comment about the work that was done here. Just to be clear, taking discretion away from judges on traffic tickets was not an objective of the interim committee, and it wasn't even really a focal point of the hearings. The objective of the committee was to take a very complicated system and look for ways to simplify and streamline it. The problem isn't so much having judges make downward departures from a fine amount. The issue is what goes into the minimum fine, what goes into the base fine, and how much variation is there around the state in tickets that are issued based on where you're pulled over, who pulls you over from what jurisdiction, and to what court do they choose to send your citation. All those variables have cause a huge amount almost randomness in what your fine amounts can be. And the objective of the committee was to find some ways to rationalize that structure. The issue of allowing a judge to make a downward departure from whatever that amount is, it, to me, is very different. The committee never made a considered decision to take that discretion away. In fact, at a key point in the process when we kind of went that direction in the name of uniformity, we hadn't even heard much from the municipal court judges. So I'm all in favor of restoring discretion. I just want it to be clear that there's a lot more going on in the bill than what we've heard so far, and the point of all this was not to take discretion away from judges, even though that is the effect, and an effect that I would happily remove.
Thank you. I want to probe a little bit more on discretion, and I agree that there is some value in having discretion on the part of certainly the law enforcement officers in the court. But I'm curious, we are here talking about fines, and some of them are substantial, but they are just fines. Do your organizations have positions on discretion in other parts of the law, for example, mandatory minimum sentences?
Co-chairs Krieger and Barker, Representative Nolan, my folks don't deal with criminal matters, felony criminal matters. The justices of the peace and the municipal judges, those that deal with any criminal matters only deal with misdemeanors. While that is discretion, we judges support judges having more discretion, we don't deal specifically with those issues, so we don't have a association position on them.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, Representative Nolan, that's not an issue that has been considered by my board.
Co-chairs Barker, Krieger, Representative Nolan, that'd be the same for the LACP. We have not.
Chiefs of police don't have a position on
Not today. I don't. I don't want to speak to that today because I'm not prepared to. To be quite honest, that's not the part I studied.
We'll follow up. Thanks.
You don't want to follow up?
Not today, but we'll explore that later.
You might have a conversation with me. There's been some conversations about the topic that you probably need to know.
Like
in fact, you'd be very interested who took part in the conversations.
Good. Thank you.
No further questions for this group? Thank you. Kim Larson, Cynthia. How do you pronounce the last name, Cynthia? Stinson. And Sybil Hibb.
My name is Kim Larson, and I'm the Director of Victim Assistance with the Marion County District Attorney's Office. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of Victim Assistance Programs, also in partnership with the Oregon District Attorney's Office, or Association, in opposition to House Bill 2712. For each of the 36 counties in the state of Oregon, there is a Victim Assistance Program. Our size and our structure varies depending upon the needs of our communities. But what remains consistent for us is how vital the funding we receive from the criminal fines and assessment account is to the sustainability of our services. As the victims' rights movement in Oregon has gained momentum over the past few years, victims have become more aware of their rights, and the demands for services from victim assistance programs have grown. The resulting laws create additional responsibilities and obligations for us, and that was met with a steady resolve by victim advocates to deliver the level of services that victims of crime are entitled to. The funding we receive through the criminal fines and assessment account is imperative in our ability to meet our obligations and provide the services to victims that the people of our state expect and mandate. Our services are available to all crime victims. In the course of any given day, we may work with surviving family members of homicide victims, victims of identity theft, burglary, robbery, child abuse, elder abuse, stalking, driving under the influence, sexual assault, domestic violence, and other assaults. Our contact with these victims is not limited to one single interaction. We work with victims throughout the course of the prosecution. Our advocates may even have been the ones to respond on the scene at the time that the crime was initially reported. Once the case is filed, we work with victims to help them understand their rights in the system and help them exercise those rights if that's what they choose to do. We ensure that those who want notice of court proceedings have that notice, and we make sure that they understand those rights and know how to participate and navigate through the system. It's not uncommon for us to sit with victims and rifle through papers and documents and receipts as we try to help them figure out their losses so that we can ask the court for restitution in exercising that right for them. If victims choose to attend hearings, we accompany them and we sit with them and make sure that they have the information they need to exercise their rights if they wish to and help them assert those rights. That could be being heard at a release hearing. It could be wanting to be heard at a sentencing, or simply the right to be present in a court hearing. We help them process what's happened to them as a result of their crime so that they're able to articulate to the judges the impact of the crime in exercising their right to make a statement about their impact. Once a case has gone through the system, we ensure that they have the information about the disposition of that case, make sure they understand what the court ordered. We also make sure that they understand what their rights are that may arise after the conviction and how to exercise those rights if they choose to. Our involvement goes through the entire court process, through that legal process, and oftentimes it goes beyond that legal process. We establish relationships with those victims that help them reach out to us as they continue to move forward in their lives, even after their cases are completed. In an effort to meet the responsibilities that we have under the law and provide the services, the victim assistance programs use the critical funding from the criminal fines and assessment account in a multitude of ways. Some of the programs use that funding to fund the only victim assistance staff person in that program. Others of us use it to support victim advocates, program directors who also provide services, restitution advocates, 24-hour hotlines, critical infrastructure, bilingual advocates, emergency funding for victims, and 24-hour response for victims. Our programs are lean. We don't have the ability to absorb reduced or lost funding without a corresponding and significant loss of services for victims of crime. Any lost funding will result in lost services. Removing the prioritization and dedication of these funds for victim services will only serve to destabilize our programs and make our responsibilities to victims and to our communities unattainable. I appreciate you listening to my testimony, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have for me.
That's Sybil.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to express concerns about House Bill 2712 in terms of the fee distribution aspects of the bill. We appreciate the work of the committee and generally appreciate and understand the concerns about being creating greater transparency and efficiency in the ways in which fines are assessed. The fine distribution aspect of the bill causes great concern for the Law Center. Many of our clients suffer from domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and child abuse. And those clients' lives are thrown into such chaos and such turmoil as a result of having suffered those crimes that the availability of essential services in the communities for those victims is of great importance to us. And so that's a reason that this bill is a priority to the Law Center. The current structure of the criminal fines and assessment account contains two critical elements to us. And one is that it creates a system of prioritization so that systems critical elements of the public safety system can be funded from the criminal fines and assessment account. The criminal fines and assessment account is created from fines assessed on and charged against people who are having an interaction with the criminal justice system. They've caused the need for criminal justice system response. They have created victims because of their behavior. It's only appropriate that those funds go to take care of and provide essential stable funding for critical victim services. And those are prioritized in the current statutory structure. Also prioritized are, as you've heard, the DPSST funding for training for law enforcement, LEDS, which is Law Enforcement Data Entry Service, and forensics. Those categories, crime victim services, LEDS, DPSST, and forensics, are all really important for the functioning of the criminal justice system, and that's really important to the ways in which our clients can achieve safety and move on in their lives in the community. So we are very supportive of the current statutory structure that creates a prioritization. We're also supportive further of the statutory structure that creates legislative findings about the way in which the CFAA ought to be used, and its primary purpose is to, in fact, take care of these systems critical elements of the public safety system. We hope that any movement forward on this bill will continue that prioritization and those legislative findings so that these essential elements are not thrown into a larger pool with many, many other competing needs and subject to very difficult conversations and greater instability each session bill moves forward. The other piece that I wanted to mention was just the specific ways in which the CFAA funds crime victim services. You heard from Ms. Larson about the district attorney-based victims assistance programs, and those are very essential to victims who are, as out of necessity, going through the criminal justice prosecution system. And the assistance of advocates like Ms. Larson and others make all the difference in the world to a victim's ability to face the fear and the trauma and the confusion of going through a criminal justice prosecution against a perpetrator who inflicted such harm. In addition to the DA-based victims assistance programs, the most critically important service from our point of view are the network of nonprofit emergency shelters across the state that provide 24-hour hotlines and shelter availability for victims and their children seeking to leave a violent home. Without the availability of those beds, victims are forced to go to the street, live in their cars, or worse yet, return home to an unsafe environment. And that's just simply not acceptable. Across the state, nonprofit victim services shelters depend on CFAA funding, and it's a critical element to them. In addition, I mentioned the network of child abuse multidisciplinary intervention services. Victims of child abuse going through the criminal prosecution system need to have the full examination and the full cooperation of the CAMI programs throughout the state in order for the prosecution to proceed, and they're very important to us as well. The last crime victim services that's funded by CFAA that I'll mention is the Crime Victims Compensation Program, and those dollars are used to help reimburse crime victims for the injuries that they've suffered at the hands of the perpetrator, and those crime payments may also help alleviate the pain and suffering felt by immediate family members who are also participating in the prosecution. These services, without these services, I feel confident that crime victims would not be able to participate in the criminal prosecution system, and I also feel confident that victims and their children and their immediate families would be less safe and in greater danger. And so I hope in this time of economic stress that we will not further de-solidify the funding that the state currently provides for those essential services, and I appreciate your time.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today. Department of Justice is neutral on this bill, so I'm giving information only to give a little bit further explanation of where the funds that come to DOJ go. As you'll see in Section 56 of the bill, several line items come to the Crime Victim Services Division with DOJ for distribution for services to victims. The first goes to the Criminal Injuries Compensation Account, and if I may, I want to explain what that means. As Sybil said, part of that money, right now about 48% of the money in that first line item goes to our Crime Victims Compensation Program that reimburses individual victims of crime, person crimes, for expenses that they've incurred as a result of the crime: medical, counseling, funeral expenses, rehabilitation, some transportation. About 52% of that line item then goes back to every county, all 36 counties, to their victim assistance programs, as Ms. Larson testified. And that money serves all victims of crime, from petty theft to homicide. They're serving all of the victims of crime in our state, and are the only programs that are serving all victims of crime. And the services, some of the services that they provide, such as notification of victims' rights, are statutorily and constitutionally mandated for those programs. Line item number two is a little cryptic. Services to children eligible for compensation, et cetera. That actually, the common terms we use for those are medical assessment only claims. A few years ago, that line item was added because the child abuse intervention centers across the state were seeing children in their centers and evaluating them based on a report of abuse. However, after interviewing the children and after a physical exam, it was determined that at that time there was no finding of abuse at that time. There was no evidence of abuse. That made those claims ineligible for our regular crime victims compensation program, because those are based on a crime being committed. So those centers were having to essentially eat the very expensive costs of those medical exams, and were looking to have to somehow prioritize cases where they were more sure about a crime having been committed than less, and as you can imagine, that's just not good for kids. So this line item was created so that our office can pay for those claims coming from those centers where an exam has been done and an interview has been conducted, but at that certain period of time, no crime has been committed. Line item number three is the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention money, or CAMI money, as you've heard it called. That money goes to all 36 counties. Statutorily mandated child abuse multidisciplinary teams function with this money, and a lot of the money flows through those teams to the 20 child abuse intervention centers across the state. And as I mentioned, they do forensic exams and interviews with children suspected of being abused. I might add for both number two and number three, the passage of Carley's Law in 2007 has really brought those funds into critical need. The extra mechanisms that have to be in place in order to comply with Carley's Law when a child has a suspicious physical injury has really been a sea change for those programs that interview children and the NDTs that staff those cases, and so that those funds are critical to those programs. And then number four is the creation of, and operation of regional centers. So those regional centers, we currently have five in the state now, offer technical assistance, training, and consultation with their area multidisciplinary teams. As you might imagine, there's expertise in various parts of the states on various areas of child abuse, such as children with disabilities, children who speak different languages, cultural issues. There's expertise in kinds of injuries, and so the regional centers serve to bring together that expertise and organize it in a way that the individual entities, the prosecutors, law enforcement, and investigators and interviewers can access that information. I also want to point out that the money in Section 55 that goes to DHS is actually critical to some of the work that we do in funding domestic and sexual violence programs, because we work with DHS to form a consolidated granting process. So a reduction of those funds actually reduces the funds that DOJ puts out in total to domestic and sexual violence services programs. So with that background, I hope you will better understand where that money flows, and do also want to bring up a concern that we have about not having a priority for victim services for these programs. Essentially, the removing the prioritization makes us a smaller fish in an even bigger pond, and victim services has historically struggled to be funded adequately and is still struggling to be funded adequately, but we have great concern that the sense of stability that programs now have, relative sense of stability that programs now have being included in the CFAA, is critically important to those programs moving forward year after year. The government-based and nonprofit programs all work on tenuous budgets. They are often the first to get cut in their county or their program, and the prioritization serves to give them some sense of stability with the funding for their program. So I would urge you to examine that prioritization, and we are hopeful that it might remain.
Any members have any questions?
I have one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cynthia, thanks for your testimony. Just really quick, and if the other two, if you would like to chime in, I'd appreciate it. It's up to you. But under 22, let's see, where is it? The bill that we're trying to fix. 2297, isn't it?
2710?
No, hang on.
Prior sessions.
Yeah, previous one. Yeah, 2287. With what we're doing right now and proposed in under 2712, it's my understanding that you're losing more funding from the way it's structured compared to that of what we're departing from on House Bill 2287.
Chair Sparker and Krieger and Representative Olson, I don't believe that 2712 actually prescribes any dollar amounts to the line items of the CFAA recipients. So I don't know that it on its face creates a loss of funding. The concern is that there will be more entities in the pond, and that without a prioritization of law enforcement and victim services, it is more easy to marginalize those and essentially have the funding diluted.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make another comment for the benefit of the committee. Just to provide some context for what was going on, why do we have this bill? We had a lot of testimony in our interim committee process, like we've heard just now, from advocates who are representing programs that currently receive dedicated funds. And as you all know, whenever there is discussion about taking a dedicated funding stream away, it creates a lot of anxiety. And certainly the intent of the interim work group was not to remove any funding from any of these programs. The context for this discussion was we're in an economic climate where public funds across the board are under increasing strain. We're making cuts to almost everything. Does it continue to make sense to have dedicated funding streams for certain programs that effectively remove them out of the ways and means process? And that's a very difficult policy decision with good arguments for and against. I just want to make it clear that cutting the budgets of any of the programs from whom we're hearing today was not an objective and may not even be the effect of this legislation. This is really a higher level ways and means discussion about whether we want to continue having a patchwork system of dedicated fees funding dedicated programs, or is it time when we're cutting budgets throughout state government to apply a ways and means type of process to everything? And again, that's a very difficult decision to which there's no right answer, in my opinion, but that is what was going on here. Just want to make that clear.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. If I may, I would just want to clarify that the current CFAA account is not dedicated. There's a legislative decision in the ways and means process that allocates dollars to the services that are currently funded through the CFAA, and they make that determination every session. It's just that right now there's prioritization and guidance to the legislature as to how those decisions should be made, and that the victim services and DPSST and forensics, et cetera, ought to be prioritized in making those determinations. So my advocacy is meant to just indicate that to the extent that this moves forward, some prioritization and guidance as to how those determinations ought to be made is to the benefit of the functioning of the public safety system and certainly to crime victims. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you. John Foote, Jane Downing, and Jason Myers.
John, that wasn't your cell phone.
Was it? Everybody was looking at you.
I raised my hand. That was not me.
All right.
Chair Krieger.
Should I go first since I was called?
That's fine.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Foote. I'm the DA in Clackamas County. I was here yesterday, and hoping to not bother you again for a while. I'm here on behalf of, in a narrow sense, the DA-based victim services programs. Which my letter, which is should be coming to you, addresses, and but I wanted to also put it in the larger context of these services. I'm the chair of the Children's Center of Clackamas County, which is the Child Abuse Center, which gets CAMI money, and obviously domestic violence cases and victims are really important to us. We have our own nonprofit in Clackamas County that provides shelter services for victims. So this is not an isolated issue. But I did want to, I appreciated what Representative Garrett's remarks about the purpose of this bill, but I would also echo the remarks you just heard about continuing the prioritization process. And it's particularly sensitive for DA programs because victims' rights are now not only in the Constitution, they're enforceable, which means if a victim is not satisfied that their rights have been honored, if for some reason we just didn't get to somebody who should have been notified and didn't give them a chance to participate, they could go to court on a mandamus and have the case sent back. This was done a couple of years ago, I think, and it was very important to the victim community that this, because they felt before they had rights, but they weren't enforceable. So what did the rights really mean? Well, of course, they meant a lot to us, but we understood what they meant. So the purpose of my letter is to let you know that this really is a different landscape than you've been funding victim services for years, but it was really more an option, and it's not an option anymore. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the funding of DA victims programs, as I imagine other programs, is a blend. In Clackamas County, the fund for the state fund only supports about 20% of our victim services. The rest is supported by either county money, over half is county money, and then some federal funds. So we need your partnership to make this work. We're not asking you for all the money. We just don't want it to be jeopardized. And there was another point, and it just This happens at my age. I apologize. And I'll
but you're looking
my remarks. Thank you, Representative Shockley. I wish I had your hairline.
Takes a lot of effort.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your time. This matters a lot to all of us. Victim advocates in our office are a very inexpensive way to serve victims. If we do it with lawyers, it costs a lot more money per case. Our victim advocates are not lawyers. A lot of times they're just regular people who really care about this particular issue and work very hard at it, and they're really good at it. And they spend most of the time with the victims, not the lawyers. They're really a branch of the lawyers, so it's a really effective program in terms of time management. So, but it's not an isolated issue. Obviously, this is in a larger context, and I don't want it to make it sound as if I'm not here or in support of all these programs, because I am. And I like the idea of continuing the prioritization, notwithstanding the other things the bill is intended to do. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and we provide victim services to individuals who are impacted by domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. We provide safe shelter, crisis intervention, transitional housing, support groups, and community education to tens of thousands of individuals every year in our community. And this year, we've received a record number of calls at a time when we've received the deepest cuts in grants and community donations in the 13 years that I've been the director. Mid-Valley is one of the nonprofit community-based shelter and advocacy programs that receive critical funding from criminal fines and assessment account. CFAA funding allows us to keep our doors open and to victims of domestic and sexual violence in a time of great need. Because this committee is considering revisions to the structure of CFAA account, we wanted to take this opportunity to let you know about our services and how important they are to victims of domestic and sexual violence. We appreciate your work on these difficult matters and hope you will consider victim services as a critical element to public safety and the justice system as you move forward. CFAA funding is critical to the stability of shelter and advocacy programs and critical to ensuring the safety of vulnerable victims and communities. When a victim of domestic violence takes the brave and terrifying step to leave an abusive relationship, it is essential that shelter, safety planning, support, and assistance be immediately available. If shelter doors are not open at that critical time or if an emergency hotline is not staffed to take a desperate call, victims and children often have no choice but to sleep on the streets or to return to an abusive home. Domestic and sexual violence shelter and advocacy programs such as ours are just one of the examples. You've heard about others that are receiving that priority, crime victims compensation programs, and also the district attorney's offices that help navigate through the criminal justice system, the child abuse assessment centers. All of us are critical to the safety net to providing support to victims of violence. Without this web of support, victims are less likely to be able to participate in effective prosecution, perpetrators are less likely to be held accountable, and victims are less likely to achieve safety for themselves and their children. For these reasons, we hope that you will consider in your revision keeping the priority for victims of violence. The severity of and lethality of cases in Oregon is extremely concerning right now. In the last 2 years, more than 65 women and children have been murdered due to domestic violence in Oregon communities. This last week, there was another homicide. These deaths left families bereft and many Oregon children orphaned. This critical need of safety net of services for domestic and sexual violence victims is already struggling to keep up with the increased need. In 2009, more than 19,000 requests for shelter from victims were turned away due to lack of sufficient shelter beds. Many of these requests are made by women who have minor children with them at the time they are seeking emergency help. The burden on service providers is increasing as victims are unable to find safe, affordable housing in their communities and are forced to stay in shelter longer. There's no question that access to emergency shelter and safety planning assistance can prevent injury, stop the cycle of violence, and save lives. Studies have shown that when victims of domestic violence are able to access shelter services when seeking to escape violence, they are 60% less likely to be severely reassaulted during the following 3 to 12 months compared to abused women who do not access shelter services in that time period. The safety net of crime victim services funding in the current CFAA is critical to the effective functioning of the public safety system. The interests of crime victims and their communities cannot be met in the most vulnerable among us, victimized by physical abuse, cannot find emergency support and assistance. The changes proposed in House Bill 2712 would destabilize critical services to victims of crime at a time when victims need us the most. We are grateful for the support that the legislature has shown to these services in past years. As the proposal moves forward, please keep the tens of thousands of victims served by this fund in your minds and in your hearts. Thank you for your attention.
Members of the committee, my name is Jason Myers, and I'm the Marion County Sheriff. And I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, who is opposed to House Bill 2712. This bill, if enacted, would actually reduce local public safety resources and personnel. It mandates a drastic change in the current fine assessment structure that justice and municipal courts, followed by requiring $40 from each fine to be paid directly to the state of Oregon. Additionally, this bill has a number of unspecified assessments which would be determined at a later time. This causes further concerns because increases in the assessment level will further negatively impact local public safety. Just to give you a little background, most counties and cities have justice and municipal courts. The revenue generated from citations written to these courts, minus the current criminal fine and assessments, usually go directly to the county or the city's general fund. At the local level, a large portion of general fund dollars, 76% in Marion County, goes towards public safety. In my county, in addition to this revenue supporting the general fund, seven traffic safety team deputies are funded as well. You might have heard about one of those traffic team deputies over the weekend stopping somebody on Interstate 5 doing 128 miles per hour in a 55 mile an hour zone. These deputies work hard keep our roadways safe, not just through enforcement, but through education and working with Public Works and Engineering. There are a number of other agencies around the state that fund officers and deputies in a similar manner. Any change to the current fine assessment system will decrease the amount of revenue that goes to county and city general funds, and in my case, dedicated deputy sheriff positions. House Bill 2712 would change the current fine assessment and consequently will adversely impact public safety efforts. Earlier I mentioned those unspecified assessments, and I'd like to comment further on that topic. The Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training receives funding from the current fine assessment structure. And in looking at this bill, I'm very concerned about an assessment category that is mentioned where there is no funding appropriated. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training provides vital role in training all of our public safety personnel in the state of Oregon. This training is fundamental to providing all men and women who serve in public safety with the skills, the knowledge, and the ability to do their job safely in a way that protects the way of life we value here in Oregon. And finally, we've heard talk about the victims assistance. That is a very necessary program. The number one person crime that we respond to at the Sheriff's Office, and I would submit is probably around the state, is domestic violence. And those services through shelter and the domestic violence program are very important to the victims of these crimes. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Just a question. If any one of you, talk to us about the ability, the options for counties and cities to replace revenue, whether it be from this source or anyplace else.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'd be glad to take a stab at that. We're just beginning our county process. Well, we're into it a little bit. We haven't submitted our proposed budgets to the county yet, but the pressure on the counties, at least in our county, and I think we're probably better off than many in Clackamas County, is growing. We're at flat funding for the last 3 years. That means agencies have the same amount of money every year, and we all know the costs go up. So trying to find more creative ways to do the same work with fewer people is really what we've been operating under. I can tell you that the reason I'm here today is because I've looked at the impact that any change to victim services would do to our victim assistance program could be dramatic. Because of the blend of funding that we have and the threats that we're facing from the federal funding, county funding, and potentially the state. In truth, we need more money from the state for victim assistance, not less. So I was very concerned that I let you know that these services are in fact mandated. So we have to find a way to do them. And I imagine that would be true of every sheriff in the state and the nonprofits, of course. I'm on a nonprofit board or two, and I know that the pressures there are greater. It's harder to raise money. So whatever the state can do to not move step back from this kind of funding and to protect it, I think that's why you're seeing people here today, is because they have blended budgets from various places, and they're worried about the threats from a variety of places, and they're hoping the state can stay strong on this funding. Since it is a dedicated special revenue, it's not general fund, and the priority system really did help. And I think that's why we're here.
A good softball question.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I tried to hit it as far as I could.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just can't help myself again. I know what a great job our good people in Clackamas County do to provide services to people that need them, but I just can't help myself. We had some bills in here about frivolous appeals the other day, and people are getting in the way of job creation. I mean, we have a bill for, we heard Native Natural Resources getting in the forests. We have a bill for removal fill, linear project bill to site power lines, pipelines, all kinds of projects. You know, our forests are burning and rotting, and you know, all you folks out there got to help us pass these bills. You do, because we're not going to raise any taxes. Now, I don't. God bless Representative Garrett for trying to do this work, but that's where the money's going to come from. Or there's going to be less money to provide the services, not just government money, but less money to give to the Clackamas Children's Center, which does great work. And this state, I think we're really at a moment where we have to change our direction. And if we don't, it's our own fault, because we're not going to tax anybody else. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for humoring me.
Thank you, Representative Schaffer. Committee members, anyone else have anything of this panel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We only have four more signed up. We'll take them two at a time, and I'll see if there's anybody else. Paul Snyder and Gail Meyer, please. Co-chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and appearing this afternoon in opposition to House Bill 2712. Most of the issues that we have with respect to this bill have already been covered. We have concerns about the way revenues are raised and the limitations that are imposed on sentencing judges. We have concerns with the way the funds are distributed after they come around the other end. One thing I'd like to mention, though, is that a number of these different add-ons have history. In fact, they all do. I understand the need for uniformity, the desirability of transparency, but it's also important to understand what arrangements were made and why they were made that resulted in the add-ons when they were created. And I'd like to just mention one, although it applies also to several of the others. The one I'd like to discuss briefly is the law enforcement medical liability account. That account was created after a series of disputes and ultimately lawsuits that went to the Supreme Court. We filed a brief in the Supreme Court in this case.
finally, the Supreme Court resolved the issue and set the stage for the creation of the law enforcement liability count. The problem that existed was that there might be several different law enforcement agencies involved in an arrest. And the defendant or the suspect might be injured during the course of the arrest. The suspect is taken to the county correctional facility, and everybody is pointing at everybody else and saying, it's not my responsibility, and the hospital and the doctors are just saying, look, somebody pay us. We don't care who does. Somebody pay us for what we've done here. What this measure did with the law enforcement medical liability account was to create a fund. And the fund is used, all it takes is the head of a law enforcement agency. Any law enforcement agency involved in that arrest has the authority to certify that this was an injury that resulted during the course of the arrest, and the law enforcement medical liability account pays it at the Medicaid rate. That was the deal that the hospitals made and the medical providers made. They said, look, if you give us some assurance that we're going to get paid, will bill through at the Medicaid reimbursement rate. So they lowered the fees, the law enforcement community got rid of the disputes, and it hasn't been a problem ever since. What concerns me is that LEMLA, as it's now called, is funded at a blank appropriation in here for the first biennium, and of course, what happens after the first biennium is anybody's guess. If it's underfunded, I don't know what that does to the deals that resulted in its creation.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Barker and Co-Chairs Krieger, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In general, we would join comments made by other parties and associations with respect to a concern of the removal of discretion of judges in the traffic court arena, and we would also, quite frankly, we understand the concern of those that are losing their prioritization of the fund. But I'm here to testify on Section 69 of the bill, because whatever should happen to the trajectory or life of the bill, we do hope that this provision does survive. And it's sort of humbling to realize that 10 characters of text, which appears on page 29, can actually have a really profound difference in how bail is managed. What Section 69 does is that it restores a cap when bail is exonerated and returned to the defendant. So we operate on a 10% security bail system here in Oregon. If bail, as an example, is set at $100,000, the defendant must deposit with the court 10% of that, so that would be $10,000. And then the state is allowed to keep 15% of that 10%. And historically, though, we've always had a cap amount. Originally in 1971, the cap was at $100. Then it was raised to $250. And the purpose for the retention of the state keeping any part of it at all when bail is exonerated is to reimburse the government, the court system, for the cost of monitoring the security bail. They have to monitor the accounts, segregate it by owner, all refund checks, that sort of stuff. And so this was simply to recap administrative expenses. In 2009, in House Bill 2287, there was no mistake made about the fact that they removed the $250 cap for one reason and one reason only, and that was to generate revenue. And I don't know who was in the room. They weren't doing the math, really, because the numbers tell the real story. For instance, a Measure 11 account, it's presumed that per count a Measure 11 crime will be $1 million in bail. Now, that doesn't normally happen. Normally, it's $250,000 per count. But if the defendant then deposits 10% of that, that's $25,000. Even if the charges are dismissed or the defendant is acquitted, or simply appears in court and bail is exonerated, the state would keep from that $3,750. Now, there's been various stories of the top end of this. The highest bail amount that I've ever heard being deposited was $5.5 million. The defendant deposited with the court $550,000. It was ultimately reduced, but the point being, without a bail cap, the state would have retained $77,500. So this has been a
bust, a boom for the state, but it's tethered to the exercise of a constitutional right. There's case law in the federal court system that says that if you use bail for any purpose other than assuring the defendant's return to court, it is by definition excessive, and it cannot be used for the purposes of generating revenue. Section 69 did is it restored a cap, and it set the cap at $750. It wasn't really indexed to the old cap of $250, but we do think that's reasonable, and we do hope that that provision does survive whatever
the future trajectory of the bill at large should be.
Okay. Committee members, you have any questions?
Thank you.
Director Williams, you've come in. Do you want to sign up?
I'm here for no purpose, Mr. Chairman. To see one of your members of the committee adjourns early.
You're the instigator of me being here to start with. Maybe we should start there. How about Gretchen Bennett and Nicolina? Is it Terzif?
I'm probably way off on that, huh?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gretchen Bennett, and I serve as the Director of Liberty House Child Abuse Assessment Center in Salem, and I'm here today with the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. Couple quick points for you. The first is that as I attended the meetings and watched carefully with a lot of respect the work of the interim justice system, it seems that with the number of changes in the fines and fees combined with the concerns that have been expressed around what the net result will be, that there's reason to be worried. Reason to be worried that there could be a net revenue loss as a result of the changes. I know there was discussion about building in contingencies, in fact, to try to offset that. So I think it's a valid question, at least because we haven't yet operated under this system, to be concerned about how the dollars will actually flow. I'm coupling that with the cuts to the program that we're already looking at in the governor's recommended budget and anticipating with the co-chair's budget, and I'm just worried. So I'm here to just express that concern. Co-Chair Krieger, you asked someone on the public side to talk about offsets and potentials. I was thinking to myself, since I started at the center, we've increased 9 times the amount of private contributions that come to Liberty House, and we're truly using these dollars to leverage tremendous private support, and I'm so proud of our local community. I also believe that we're leveraging a good return on investment with these children. I've got good data that shows that kids are more likely to be connected with the medical care they need, the long-term mental health supports that they need, that it ends up costing less money overall when you do it well the first time. And I just think that we contribute in so many ways to an overall return on investment for some of Oregon's most vulnerable kids. I know I don't need to describe to you the kinds of kids that come to Liberty House, and I welcome you if you ever do want to see that. On a personal note, I had the chance to tour recently some of our public safety institutions, including DPSST, and there's really something about being in there and being with your public safety officials that just makes it, in addition to an intellectual issue, a real heart issue. I can't tell you enough how much I'm personally just wanting to see strong support in the public safety arena. And I want to quickly mention a couple of other things. We're a very unique service. The delivery of child abuse assessment work is unduplicated in the system. There's no one that provides these types of coordinated assessment services for kids, so I do want you to understand it's a unique service that's delivered. I want to request respectfully that if any work groups are created, I'd be so honored to be able to have our voice at the table and serve on that. And I also want to just close by saying that we certainly currently have and would continue to expect legislative oversight over these dollars. I know I've gone before Public Safety Subcommittee at Ways and Means for years and talked about the outcomes that we're getting with these dollars, and I would expect that to continue, of course, and so just wanted to respectfully explain that part of things as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicolina Terzieff, and I'm here today proudly representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We are the 49 nonprofit domestic violence service providers across the state in each of your districts and more. We are serving communities all around the state by providing those kinds of emergency level services. Our folks, like Jane, the people that you've heard from in 48 other nonprofits, are the people that meet the battered, the abused at the door, give them blankets, give them the immediate medical attention, give them hotel vouchers if there's no room to stay. I just want to highlight for you and underline that the direct connection that the dollars we're talking about here today, the prioritized dollars that we're talking about here today, what they translate to. They translate to 19,000 more people getting beds, unlike those who were turned away last year. They translate to mothers with children who don't have to ride the max lines all night or camp in the woods as their safest alternatives. I know you know the importance of these, and I won't take up much more of your time. I will open up for any questions.
Any members? Okay, thank you. Chair. As if today.
So we've heard all the testimony, Mr. Chair?
We're going to ask if there is anyone out here that does want to come up. Is there someone that does want to come up? Okay, come on up.
Okay. My question is this. Where are we going with this?
That's what I'm going to talk about when we're done.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's one fine piece of legislation. That's all I got to say.
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Lane County is opposed to this bill. We did testify in opposition during the interim committee. The point I'll just briefly bring to the committee's attention is the exact same point I made to you on 2710, which is that if one of the charges of the committee was to examine collections of fines, that is not, you won't find anything about improved collections of fines in this bill. And Representative Schaffler, if you want to bring more money without doing anything, we could give us some additional tools to perform collections, and we'll bring some more money in, because we're losing an awful lot of money through not being able to collect fines at both the state court level and the local court level.
Mr. Chair, I don't know where the gentleman got me suggesting we get more money without doing anything, but when I figure out how to do that, I'll make sure he gets some of it.
You know what? I will chime in on that. If I can,
I know.
I know.
Could restrain yourself.
I tried. The notes were flying. You know what? His last point about collections is very sound. I have wondered for a while how much money, how many tax dollars we spend within our court system tracking down fines, fees, assessments that don't even get paid. I mean, Lane County's probably got tens of millions of dollars in unpaid. And the way I understand it goes is judge orders, defendant upon conviction to pay the fine. That goes to the court for collection. If it doesn't get collected, then goes to the Department of Revenue. Okay, so somebody at the court here is getting paid to track down the money, and then Department of Revenue gets referred out there. Somebody at Department of Revenue gets paid tax dollars to track down the money, and then if they can't get it, then it either goes back to the court. I think if there's a certain condition, it'll go back to the court, or Department of Revenue then turns it over to a collection agency who's got a contract the taxpayers are paying with the government to run that. And so it's like, you assess a $272 fine, and I wonder if we spent like $1,000 to try and track down the $272. And I know this is not particularly the issue of the day, but I did want to elaborate on that, because if we're going to be doing a work group looking into fees, that's probably somewhere, not this time, but down the road, it's worth somebody putting a number on. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd just like to respectfully request that if you intend to appoint a work group on this bill, that I not be appointed to that work group.
We were counting on you because of your past history and knowledge of being an attorney, thoughtful that you could maybe, I would suggest, if it's okay with my co-chair, that we get together with staff and have a little discussion of where we need to go with this bill, or if we need to go anywhere. I do think, though, this is the first bill that's gone through a work group that long and is this large, and virtually everybody's against it, which is kind of strange.
I almost, because of Representative Tomei's comment, was going to go out and try to find somebody, you know.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, I would really be interested in, I know Representative Garrett talked briefly about this legislation and why it's a good idea. I'd really like to hear from somebody in more depth about why this is a good idea. I'm hearing a lot about why it isn't, but, you know, after all the hours and hours that was put into this.
Well, Mr. Chair, in all seriousness, I think that would be wise, because this didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of House Bill 2287, which was a temporary Band-Aid to keep our justice system functioning last session. And there were a lot of flaws in how 2287 was constructed, and that the Interim Committee was tasked with trying to both come up with a permanent solution that would keep the system functioning and also make improvements. I think there are elements in here in this bill that are worth trying to salvage. Again, a lot of this is not should judges have discretion to lower a ticket or and how revenue should be distributed. It's how is the fine calculated in the first place, and should that be so dependent on where you are in the state, who pulls you over? Is it a sheriff's deputy, a police officer, a state police officer? Do they choose to send you to a municipal court, traffic court, state court for that county? There's a lot to be said for having some standardization introduced into this system. I would hate to see that concept completely lost. So I hope we don't just throw this out. And I would advocate having someone who could speak with more expertise than me come in to give a presentation.
Probably we'll have that done. If we get stuck on first base, we'll probably ask you to step up and try to help us get out. Representative Nolan.
Mr. Co-Chair, I think it's a good move to have a bit of a work group focused on this. I do think not just our good colleague here on this dais, but Representative Nathanson and Senator Verger, who co-chaired that work group, could bring some value to that discussion. I would suggest that we think a little bit, not just about this bill, but more generally, as we balance some very tough competing interests this year. It may actually be a reflection of good work that a lot of people who are concerned about this issue are uncomfortable with a little bit about it, and I don't mean to mischaracterize or put words in people's mouth, but when you're trying to find a compromise among a number of competing interests, if everybody gives a little in order to achieve a greater good, like consistency and dependability and predictability, no matter where you are in the state, then maybe, in fact, that's the right outcome. We often say in negotiations that I do, if everybody's a little cranky, maybe we've hit the sweet spot, and maybe that's something we should think about with this bill as well.
Okay, anything further? Okay, we'll close the...
Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair. One final comment. I'm concerned about how we got here and how much time and effort and staff time and expense at the state level was incurred to get to a place that everybody is so unhappy with. And I wanted to express that for the record. No slam on Representative Garrett. Please don't take it that way. But how did we go wrong? What stakeholders should have been there that weren't? Why weren't they there? I think those are important questions that we need to ask. And then secondly, I do think that, you know, a lot of people were concerned about the issue of the lack of discretion. You know, why couldn't we discuss sideboards? 10% in either direction, 20% in either direction. Then we accomplished some modicum of what they set out to do in the first place, which I think is a good value, more consistency. But we don't completely throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of discretion. You know, if we're going to move forward trying to salvage it, that could be some places to start.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Co-Chair.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2712 and close the hearing of the committee for today.